Hey, it's Rebecca Greenfield, the host of The Paycheck. Welcome to the second installment of our conversation series about women, work, money, and sexism. A lot of times when women talk about this stuff, we do it discreetly, over drinks or in text messages. We want to change that, and this series is our opening move. Today we have two more conversations for you. First up is the world of competitive poker, where the stakes are high and the representation of women is low.
97% of poker players who are professional are men. So male-dominated. It's like super male-dominated.
That's Annie Duke. In the 1990s, as poker was breaking into the mainstream, she was one of the only women at the table. And she won the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions in 2004. She talks with Maria Konnikova, a best-selling author and journalist who recently put her writing career on hold to play poker. Within a year, she's won more than $200,000 at the tables.
I'm Maria Konnikova, and I am now a professional poker player, part of Team Poker Stars Pro. But I came to this because I'm a writer by background and training and was writing a book about poker and then got sucked into the world of poker players.
I'm Annie Duke, and I feel like I have the mirror image of Maria. So I was a poker player for a very long time, a professional poker player. I retired in 2012 and became a writer.
What actually drew you to poker? I doubt that many girls, I know that I definitely didn't grow up being like, you know, I want to be a poker player when I grow up. So how does one go from UPenn cognitive psychology to deciding, you know what, I'm going to go to Vegas and play professional poker?
I think the only way I could have ended up being a poker player was through total accident. I was just going off to graduate school, and I went off to graduate school, and I finished my 5 years there, did all of my dissertation work. And as I was about to go out for professorships, I got really sick. So I ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. And as you know, in academics, it's a seasonal job market. So I whiffed that year's job market, and I had to wait a year. So during that year, I was recuperating. And I didn't have any money because, you know, I was getting my money from teaching and from my fellowship. And so now I was taking time off. And my brother actually said, well, you've watched me play poker a lot. Why don't you try playing? And that was the end of that.
It's so funny that you describe it that way, because the way that I got into poker was also having this bad health experience where, like, I had this weird autoimmune condition. No one knew what it was. I went to all these specialists. My body was just covered in hives. Like, sometimes I couldn't even go outside. It was awful. It made me kind of realize just how little control we have over our lives in the big scheme of things. And I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do for my next book. And I was like, I want to write about luck and the role of luck in our lives, how we can figure out what we can and can't control, how you can learn to maximize the control parts and deal with it when things that you can't control happen. And that's how I got to the poker world.
One of the things that I really interested me with Maria was that our backgrounds were so incredibly similar. So now, finding this out, we both came to poker because we got sick, which is just another little bizarre twist in there. When I went into poker, I thought, this is something I'm going to do, and literally nobody will ever know my name. When it did become a big deal on television, which happened right around 2003, then being a woman actually ended up being a really big advantage. But I also feel like being a credentialed woman was a really big advantage. I mean, after all, I did have my master's. So it was this, you know, the double Ivy League combined with the four children, combined with professional poker player, that allowed me to really get a leg up. But it wasn't something that I could have imagined or planned for.
I think it does help to be differentiated, that people remember you and that they're like, oh, well, this is the girl who not only went to college, you know, she then went to grad school and she's still playing poker.
Right. Exactly. And it's, then you obviously have the unusual story of your trajectory as well.
I think
super helpful.
I'd like to apply for a most creative use of a psychology PhD award.
You should get that. It was interesting. Like when there was sort of a bright side and a dark side for me when I started off as a woman in the game. So just to give you an idea, 97% of poker players who are professional are men. So, I mean, when they talk about male dominated, it's like super male dominated. So there's this very interesting thing about poker, which is that in order for it to be fun for people, they have to be playing for an amount of money that can hurt them if they lose. It's just a fact. If you're playing for peanuts, nobody cares. Nobody has fun playing the games. So when people are losing an amount of money that matters to them, you're not necessarily seeing the best versions of themselves in front of you. So I got called a lot of terrible names. I got, you know, propositioned. If I refused the proposition, I would get called frigid. I got called the C word all the time. And this was like, I'm not kidding, like a daily occurrence. And what would happen is I would look over to the floor, who's the guy who's supposed to be like keeping control of the game and making sure that things aren't getting out of hand. And I would be like, hey, like this thing just happened. And the response would be, well, you can leave. You're like, you're here voluntarily. Like, why do you care? But you came in after I retired. So I would love to hear, like, what was your experience of that like?
Yeah. So some things are the same and some things have changed. You still get called to the poker table. That is just, that's a fact of life. That's happened to me. And you do get still called frigid, but my favorite is frigid set, because apparently they don't understand the irony of that formulation. What has changed is that the best casinos are really trying to do something about it. So I had something really horrible happen to me at the Wynn. And I've only been propositioned once. That's where it happened. And I called over the floor. First of all, the dealer had my back. He was like, this happened. This guy has been totally out of line for the last hour. And he just said this to her. And the floor responded and said, you know, it's not okay. And we got moved to different tables so that I didn't have to deal with him anymore.
Yeah.
So at least they're trying. You can't prevent those guys from being and completely inappropriate, but they're making an effort. I hope that in one version of the future, the guy who propositioned me doesn't just get moved tables, but gets a penalty.
Yeah.
So hopefully that day will come. And there still aren't that many of us. And near the end of the day, when people are drinking, they're
tired. They're drinking.
Yeah,
they're
emotional. They're losing. They can be really, really nasty. And sure, they can be nasty to men as well, but they're very personally nasty to women.
Yeah. In a very like sexualized way.
Absolutely.
I find.
Absolutely.
And this kind of goes back to the what do you have control over and what don't you have control over? And I thought, well, I don't really have a lot of control over that. And I started to try to think about how can I personally exist in this world? How can I not make this toxic emotionally for me, number one? So how can I sort of create a viewpoint where I'm okay with this and understanding that this is the job that I've chosen to do, and how can I do it effectively? And then also, how can I take the fact that people are reacting to me this way and use it to my advantage? Because isn't that kind of, in the end, the best revenge against somebody who's thinking about you that way and treating you that way?
Yeah, but you're much more mature. I just got noise-canceling headphones.
Well, we didn't have those, by the way. We didn't have, you know, when I started playing, there were no, I guess you could have a Walkman.
So, no, I mean.
Which dates me.
That I say that as half jokingly. I did get noise-canceling headphones in response to one guy, actually. It was a direct cause and effect. He kept calling me little girl, and that sounds totally, you know, that's not terrible, but it just, he kept doing it. And he was very smart. He was a good player, but he knew that he was getting to me, and he got to me, and he ended up knocking me out of the tournament. And the very next day I went and I got noise canceling headphones, and I had never in my life bought a pair of expensive headphones. So glad I did it. Such a great purchase. The other thing that you say though is incredibly relevant, which is, you know, everyone has emotional biases. Everyone has hot triggers. That's why they're hot triggers. Everyone gets emotional, especially when you're tired and you're stressed and you haven't slept. So there's nothing that depletes you quite as much as sleep deprivation. But some players, like if it's getting to them, if you see that they're lashing out at you, then maybe someone else got to them. Then you can be the one who observes that and who benefits from it.
I know for me, it's hard for me to feel like someone doesn't like me. And I think that that's more of a problem for women than men. And I had to sort of figure out a way to get over that. And, you know, I would try to say to myself and then counsel other people, your job at a table is not for someone to like you. And your job at a table is not for someone to respect you. In fact, that's actually counterproductive. So it's better for you if they don't respect you. It's better for you if they don't like you. So what I started saying to myself as a mantra was, if I had a problem in my life that I needed advice on, would I ask this person for advice? And obviously someone who's like telling me, oh, sweetie, I'm so sorry I won that pot from you. There's a hotel across the street. Do you want to go get your money back? I'm not ever asking that person for any advice. Thank you very much. So once I sort of talked myself through that, what I realized is that if I wouldn't ask them for advice about something important, then their opinion is of no interest to me. And I think that that actually really helped me to sort of separate out me not getting emotionally involved. Because a lot of the power that they have over you in those situations is that you get emotionally involved in the situation, it starts affecting your play. And you lose kind of the one way that you can get your vengeance, you know, that you can sort of avenge your honor, which is to actually take their money. And your only other choice would be, well, I'm quitting the game.
Poker can be very lonely. I mean, you are by yourself. Even though you're always at a table with people, it's something where ultimately you have to rely on yourself. That's another reason why I actually really like the game, because it's a very good analog for what happens in life, where ultimately you are self-reliant to a huge degree, and then you have people, key people who can support you along the way. And yet when you're making those decisions, you know, when you're at that table, you're by yourself.
You know, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on why there are so few women playing poker, because I'm not sure that you can find a profession where the percentage is actually smaller.
Yeah, I don't think you can.
You know, I mean, outside of like the NBA, but that's by definition, right?
Exactly. Unless it's definitional. I don't think you can. You're saying NBA is part of the answer. So when you do watch poker, it's on ESPN, and it's not like there's a men's league and a women's league, thank God, but you see men. And so it's never crossed my mind, oh, I can be a professional poker player. It's just, unless you're already in the poker world, it's very rare to even be aware of female players. And so one of the reasons that, you know, I've decided to really commit myself to the game, to become a professional, to take a sponsorship from PokerStars, is because I do think it's an incredible game, and I do want more women in it, because I think that women make incredible poker players. And I think the game would benefit if there were more women in the game.
When I think about why there aren't a lot of women, I think, first of all, there's just this huge barrier to entry, which is you really do take a lot of abuse. And I think there's only a certain type of woman who's like, no, but I love this game so much that I am willing to make this trade. Because it's very hard to kind of live in that environment where the features that you need in order to succeed in the environment are considered negative when you're wearing them, but positive when the person sitting next to you is wearing them. I would hear them talk about my male counterparts using literally the exact same adjectives, the exact same adjectives. And it would be so complimentary. It'd be like, he's so ambitious and competitive, intense, and look how hyper-focused he is, and whoa, you know? And then they would say the same thing about, not just me, like about any of the women playing. And it was really not being said in a nice way. Like, oh, she's so competitive, right? And they're just calling you a bitch is what they're really doing.
Absolutely. And I think that's true across a lot of the similar disciplines, business, law, just anywhere. The same traits that get you to the top are also seen as bad and then prevent you from getting to the real top, because who wants someone who's very competitive and ambitious and female? You want someone who's nice.
Right. Exactly. Like, why can't you be nicer? Why can't you smile more? Think about something else where we're doing some kind of business against each other, we're trading against each other, and it's literally you lose to me and you have to give me your money right then. And I think that that makes it so much harder, because they have to look at you and you're a woman. And for a certain percentage of men, that's a statement about their masculinity.
A lot of the things that happen in poker is it's making explicit what's implicit in a lot of other areas. everything in life has an element of chance, right? So when people are like, oh, but there's chance in poker. Well, there's chance in everything. And poker is just visible, right?
Right,
in poker,
exactly.
You can see the chance element.
I used to say, like, do you really think that there's no luck in the things you do? There's luck in taking a shower. And then people will laugh. And I would say, well, when I was growing up, all the plumbing was connected in the house. So if someone remotely in the house flushed a toilet, it affected the temperature of the shower and it was really awful. So that was the example that I used to give. But it's not that you make your own luck. It's that you make your own decisions that which then change the probabilities of all the different outcomes that could occur.
Absolutely.
And that's something that you get like so comfortable with in poker. Some people, when they say, I think you make your own luck, what they're really saying is, I think you make your own decisions. And I wish they would just say that.
Yes.
Because I think it can be really misunderstood. And then there's other people who I think really do believe, like, you make your own luck.
Yep.
And it's like, no, that's not going to help you.
Those are the same people who say luck is preparation and opportunity. To
right.
which I say, no, that's preparation and opportunity.
That's
not luck.
Professional poker is not a traditional workplace. Yet, what Annie and Maria described probably sounds at least a little familiar to many working women. And that's because no matter the workplace, women are fighting for a seat at the table. In poker, there's just actually a table. And if you let the bullies win, you literally have to give up your seat. Next up, we'll hear from two journalists who are also trying to make it on their own. Welcome back. Manoush Zomorodi was the host of the popular WNYC show Note to Self. But this year, she quit to start her own company. It's called Stable Genius Productions, and their first project is a podcast that she hosts called Zigzag. She's talking to Rose Eveleth, a freelance journalist who hosts her own show, Flash Forward. They both specialize in reporting about science and technology. We're going to pick up with Rose talking about one of her earliest assignments when she was working at the student radio station at NYU.
One of the stories I did was about this project that a major auto manufacturer was doing, essentially to pump engine sounds back into the cabin for certain cars, because today's cars, right, you don't really hear the engine. The engine is pretty well insulated, so you don't get that kind of old school, like, revving feeling in your car. And so I interviewed the guy behind this project, and I asked him, I was like, you know, as a driver, like, I don't miss that. Like, that's not that important to me. Like, I'm kind of curious, like, why you are spending all this money on doing this thing. And his answer was, well, you're a woman. And so you don't really know much about cars. So let me explain to you, like, how important it is for men to be able to really hear, you know, their car engine. And then to just sort of put a cherry on top, he was like, also, take, for example, like, you understand vacuums, right? Like, if you were using a vacuum and you couldn't hear it, it would be weird. And then afterwards, he started sending me emails with links to porn in them, which I suspect wouldn't have happened if I was a man.
Wow. Wow. Did you respond?
No, I didn't respond. I was like, this is so clearly just like not even in the realm of appropriate. I thought about forwarding it to his employer, like the PR people at said large motor company. But I didn't do that because the last thing I need is a aggrieved man who now has a lot of time on his hands to come find me.
Yeah, no, that would not be good. I just finished reading the article in The New Yorker about pay parity at the BBC. And that was really a hard read for me because I know all the people who were mentioned in that article. And I worked with them 20 years ago. And I feel like I'm reevaluating all the career moves I did or didn't make in the late 90s or early aughts, based on what has happened with the Me Too movement, with this movement for pay parity. And I, you know, think back, like, never asking how much I would be paid, just being so grateful that I'd been given the chance or the job, never having a mentor who to talk me through any of the financial stuff, looking around the foreign news desk at the BBC and realizing there was not a single woman who had children who also traveled. And that being the reason why I decided to come off the road, because I wanted to have a family. And I just didn't see anyone who had managed to do that. And so I thought, you know, well, that's a choice that you have to make. I want to go back and redo so many conversations or things that I did, or also wish that there was solidarity between the women working together that I see that there is now, because there was not. The sense was there were only a few spots, and get your elbows out, ladies.
You mentioned that you, at the time at BBC, didn't have like a mentor or a woman you could go to. Did you ever find that person?
I don't know that I ever did find that financial person. Do you have that person in your life?
I do work in a lot of different mediums. So I, you know, I write print features, I write web features, I like do a bunch of things, and I also do radio, and I'm a freelancer. And so all of that kind of makes it slightly harder to find a singular mentor, right? I don't have a workplace that I could go look for somebody. And then also, like, you know, I might have someone who is really helpful on the radio front, but like can't tell me a single thing about word rates for a print magazine, you know? I hear all these people talk about like find your mentor. And I'm always like, but like, how do you find that person? You know, it's like, it's a little weird. And yeah, do you ask like, hey, will you be my mentor? Like, that sounds like a really like cheesy, weird thing to ask. I have found, and I sort of hate that this is the case, is that the most helpful people to me on the finance thing, or at least on the in the context of making sure that I get paid a fair amount, have been really well-established men, because A, they're not worried that if they tell me how much they make that they're going to lose their contract at like Nat Geo or whatever it is. And B, you know, they feel some responsibility to kind of help.
I would say I have had the reverse happen to me, where I've had a young woman come to me and ask for advice, which I have offered. And I will tell you what has happened. She has gone and gotten the job and never talked to me about it again. And that is such bad form. If you are going to go to a woman who you look to for advice or mentorship, and they sit down and give you the time to think through what the best strategy is to get what you want, both in terms of potentially flexibility or salary, it's your job to report back and to thank them. That has really bothered me in the past. So Rose, when you like are thinking ahead, how far ahead are you thinking? Are you thinking like, I got to get like my earnings up for 2018, or I've got a 5-year plan, or in 20 years, I will have written 3 books? Like, how do you look at your career going forward?
It says B. Manoush in big block letters. I wish. That'd be great. I have a 1-year plan, a 5-year plan, and a 10-year plan. My 1-year plans generally tend to be things like, by the end of this year, I want to have written X number of features, published this many things, you know, grown the audience or flash forward to this number. Those are kind of more like goals that are specific. The 5-year plan is more general of like, what are some big picture ideas or big places I'd like to try? And those are more like, I would like to try writing a TV show. And then the 10-year plan is really imagining, you know, if people know who I am, which TVD. But if people do know who I am in 10 years, like, what do they think of as like, oh, Rose is the person who does blank. And so for me, my 10-year plan is, you know, oh, she's the kind of person who makes these like weird experimental multimedia projects that are surprising and fun and interesting. And that's kind of how I imagine the future. But what about you, Manoush?
I am very aware that happens, and it can completely change the way you think about your life, which is what has happened to me. I mean, I'm about, what, 4 months into owning my own company. I gave up a podcast that I loved making, that was doing very well. And this thing is happening in real time right now. And so it has been an incredible lesson to me to stop planning and be in the moment, because I have no choice. But I will say this, like, I am, and I don't want to sound like morbid in any way, but like, my kids are getting older. They're only going to be home for like the next decade. It's like, that's it. That's my time I have with them. But it's also, I'm at the peak, I think, of my earning potential. And so, plus also my parents are getting older. So I feel like, I feel a little nervous and anxious about what I want to achieve, not just for me, but for my kids, for my parents, so that I feel like I gave this whole life thing all I could. I really want it to have meaning. Yes, I also want to pay our mortgage, and I also don't want to have to work till I'm 95 years old, but the meaning part really, really matters.
Solidarity is something that keeps coming up in these conversations, and it's true. It's been pretty scarce for most professional women. It's not always easy to say out loud what you've been taught to keep quiet, whether that's harassment or the size of your bonus. But then something like Me Too comes along, and these private conversations women have been having become a lot more public. And then we see how powerful speaking up can be. Thanks for listening to another episode of The Paycheck. We're back next week with more conversations. If you like our show, or if there's anything you want to add to the conversation, please head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to rate, review, and subscribe. This show was edited by Janet Paskin, produced by Topher Forges, and hosted by me, Rebecca Greenfield. I moderated today's conversations. We also had production help from Jillian Goodman, Francesca Levy, and Liz Smith. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts.